Yes, indeed. That's who we are, the Voice of Barbados. And on Sunday evenings, around this time, we present to you the Better Health Radio Show. And we want to thank the good doctors that come around and share all this information with you. And this evening, we have Dr. Adanna Grandison, and she has her cohorts with her to spread some information. So we're going to get to her and let her welcome her guests, as she usually does. So pleasant evening to you, Dr. Grandison.
Good evening to you too, Gregson, and to the Barbados community out there listening on the Better Health Show this evening. I want to start off this evening by letting all of our listeners know that just yesterday was World Cancer Day. And as such, we thought it appropriate to certainly have two of our guests this evening with us. And both of these guests are no strangers to the world of cancer. Certainly, we have this evening Dr. Greg Padmore. Dr. Greg Padmore graduated from medical school at UWA in 2011, and he completed his internship at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in 2012, where he actually became the intern of the year at completion. Following this, he entered the Department of Surgery and completed his Doctor of Medicine in General Surgery in December of 2018. He subsequently pursued two subspecializations, first in hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgery, and then surgical oncology at the University of Calgary, Canada, between 2020 and 2022. He has since returned and is working as a consultant general and hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgeon and surgical oncologist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. And our second guest is Dr. Vikash Chatrani. Dr. Vikash Chatrani, a Barbadian born, attended the Queen's College before he started his training at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica in 1997. Having completed his preclinicals, he returned to Barbados to complete his MBBS degree, attaining honors in obstetrics and gynecology, general surgery, and pharmacology. He was valedictorian for his year, having gotten the gold medal in surgery for all three campuses and the recipient of numerous praises for his results in the MBBS examination. Dr. Chatrani started off his obs and gynae career in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynae at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital after completing his internship in 2003 and worked for 4 years before leaving for Jamaica to complete his doctorate in obstetrics and gynecology. He is a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists and was the chair of the West Indies section of ACOG before moving to do his fellowship in gynae oncology and minimal access surgery at Tata Memorial Hospital in Mumbai, India. On Dr. Chatrani's return to the QEH in October 2012, he was the catalyst in the Obstetrics and Gynecology Department, forming a specialist gynae oncology firm which addresses all of the island's gynecological cases and oversees the colposcopy clinic. He is currently a consultant at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, a clinical director at the Barbados Cancer Society, and he is also the assistant treasurer for the Barbados Association of Medical Practitioners, a specialist surgeon to the Healthy Caribbean Coalition, an associate lecturer with the University of the West Indies. Good evening, Drs. Chatrani and Dr. Padmore. Welcome and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Adana. Good evening. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me here.
Great. So I wanted to start off this discussion because, as I started off by saying, yesterday was World Cancer Day. And so it comes as no surprise that we decided really to take a look at cancer. But what really is cancer? When we think about cancer, it's a disease which can essentially occurs when there are changes in a group of cells, normal cells, where essentially they are unregulated, unrestricted, and therefore the growth is uncontrolled. And we now have abnormal growth, which can form a tumor. The only scenario that doesn't occur in is really leukemia. And if these tumors are left untreated, certainly they can spread and affect other tissues in the body that were normal, they can now be affected by that cancer. I thought that it would be important that we cover two cancer types this evening, one being colorectal carcinoma, and the second being cervical carcinoma. And persons may ask why. And certainly when we look at the local statistics in Barbados, certainly our statistics from 2020, we can see that colorectal cancer across all both sexes and all age groups is ranked as the third, coming in at 12.8% of all cancer types. And we know that, for instance, the cervical cancer, although not seen as commonly when compared with some of the other more prominent cancers, is the cancer type that is 100% preventable and should not exist. And so I thought it would be extremely important to have our two surgeons here coming to share lots of critical information. And I believe prevention is better than cure. And so it's very important that we get right to the conversation of screening. So I want to start off this evening, Dr. Padmore, if you could just tell us a bit about the progression of colon cancer from that first polyp all the way through to possible cancer, and then allow us to know why it is important for screening. And then I'll go over to Dr. Charani.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Adana. Thanks again for having me.
In
general, colon cancer all starts from a polyp, as you rightly said. And a polyp really is a protrusion or growth of the wall of the colon. And as you get older, the mucosa or the lining of the colon gets predisposed to developing these polyps. In general, the progression from a polyp to a cancer in a patient that doesn't have any predisposition, it takes about 10 years to occur. So it is a slow growth, and also similarly to like cervical, is something that we could kind of prevent before it reaches that point. So then the question comes on how do we prevent it? And As you might imagine, these polyps are small. They tend to be like less than a centimeter. So in general, these patients with polyps are asymptomatic, meaning they don't have any obvious symptoms of having it there. So then you have to look at what modalities are available at in detecting these before it gets to a cancer. And as you rightly said, screening is really the answer for that.
Dr. Charani, I'm going to let you come in now to explain to us, because I know within the medical fraternity, we certainly can appreciate and do strongly believe that cervical cancer is 100% preventable. But can you tell us about that progression in terms of from the point of exposure with the virus that is usually the cause of cervical carcinoma, all the way to cervical carcinoma presenting, and how do we handle that patient? I think we just lost Dr. Charani.
Yeah, it looks that way.
Okay, not a problem. So what I'll do, Dr. Padmore, given that Dr. Charani just dropped off, we'll just continue talking about some of those screening modalities. But before we go there, tell us about the risk factors associated with colon cancer, which essentially predisposes a person and causes them to be at higher risk of developing colon cancer.
Yeah. So when we look at risk factors, we generally know that you have risk factors which we can change, which are the modifiable risk factors. And then there's non-modifiable risk factors, which includes like our genetics, our ethnicity, age. The modifiable ones include diets high in red meats. In general, there isn't any one factor that would say you would predispose you to colon cancer, but a culmination of all them. And the non-modifiable one is especially for our population, it is known that the Afro-Caribbean or African-American population also have a higher risk of developing polyps and, in essence, colon cancer. And as we get older, we also, the mucosa or the lining of the colon starts to become more at risk for forming polyps. So that kind of draws into the general age at which we should start to screen, which is around the age of 45. And that's both for male and females in the, and this is in the average risk population, meaning no obvious risk factors for colon cancer, no family history. And when we say family history, generally mean any first degree relatives, so your parents, a sibling, with who were diagnosed with colon cancer. Those patients, we look at the age of diagnosis, because if the age of diagnosis is like less than 50, that is one of the higher risk factors for this patient. And in general, the thinking then in those populations is to screen 10 years before that relative's diagnosis. But for average risk persons, which is the general population, screening should start from age 45.
And Dr. Padmore, I wanted to, you mentioned something there that I think is key, and that is family history. How important really is it to know your family history? Because I know quite often within the Barbadian context, at least, we are quite reluctant to share our family history with other members of the family. How important really is it for a person to know their family history, know the illnesses that mommy and daddy may have had, granny, those types of things?
Yeah, but it's quite important, because it helps us as physicians, as surgeons, to hone in on which patients are at a higher risk for developing any particular disease. In this case, we look at is cancer. So having a good idea or understanding of not just that your sibling or your mom had cancer, but just the type of cancer, what age they were diagnosed at, because it likely would influence how we approach you as an individual as well. So having a good idea, you may not know the exact diagnosis, but just have some might say you had bowel cancer, for example. Those things are important for us to determine what your risks are as an individual.
So Dr. Chaturani, I see that you're back. Great. I know technology always gets the better of us. But I just wanted to start off the conversation on your end. Can you share the progression from exposure to HPV virus, human papilloma virus, really to cervical carcinoma?
Oh, right. So I just wanted to mention to our listeners, we hear a lot about cancer in recent times, and it seems that we keep hearing it over and over and over again. The WHO actually shows cancer to be on the rise. And we ask ourselves, but we're so focused on healthy lifestyles and doing the right thing, we're visiting our doctors, but still cancer is on the increase. And we have to ask ourselves why. And I always tell the audience when we have this discussion is that it's because of improvements in healthcare. And they wonder, but how can improvements in healthcare cause cancer to rise? The reason for that is because we end up living longer. We're no longer dying from things like diabetes, hypertension, tuberculosis, HIV, AIDS, you know. So with improvements of healthcare, we live longer. Now, because of that, living longer, you're going to likely develop cancer in your lifetime. And that's why it's key to prevent them. And cervical cancer specifically is cancer of the cervix, which is the neck of the womb. That's why women do their pap smears, which is to detect these abnormalities early. Now, you may wonder, well, why do we need to start screening at an early age, like age 21, which is what we do in Barbados, right? It's because we've now found, and people won Nobel Prizes for this, that a virus, HPV, is responsible for cervical cancer. And this is not, when we hear virus, we think about, you know, the pandemic in the 80s with the occurrence of HIV. HPV is different to any other virus in terms of HIV, or it's similar to the common cold. Everybody who has skin-to-skin contact can catch HPV. So it's a very common virus. We always say that Over 80% of the population would have been exposed to HPV at one point in their lifetime by the age of 50. But it doesn't mean that all of us will get cancer. The reason being, we have healthy immune systems. The same way we get a cold, we don't progress to pneumonia and die. Our immune system kicks in and fights it off. But with HPV infection, even though we fight it off majority of the time, there are these high-risk strains of HPV which cause persistent infection. And persistent infection means it's not going to cause cancer tomorrow. It takes time. It goes through these changes over years. It can take up to 8 to 15 years for an HPV infection to cause abnormalities. And then these abnormalities will progress into cancer. And that's why it's very important for women to get screened and tested. Because if we can pick up these abnormalities in that time frame between the 8 to 15 years before it transforms into cancer, we can prevent cervical cancer. So to be honest with you, cervical cancer is on the decline since the 1970s, since the advent of the Papanicolaou smear or the Pap smear. And this was a test devised by George Papanicolaou where you take cells from the cervix. And to be honest with you, the Pap smear has become part of women's DNA. They don't think about it. You know, they go to the doctor, they expose themselves, they put their legs up in the stirrups, and they allow the doctor to take that sample from the cervix. And it's different to the men, because the women come forward and get screened. The men are the ones who are a little hesitant to see the umpire, because you know he uses that finger to go and test the prostate. But we have to give credit to our women, because they've been coming forward, they've been getting screened, they've been tested, and we're actually preventing cervical cancer. And that's why we see a decline in the cervical cancer incidence in Barbados, especially over the last 10 years.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chatrani. I know you've sort of put me square in the headlights now, because I usually tend to always have a small component, if it is small, but I always tend to have some sort of component during the presentation, especially for the men. But guys, I did not forget you this evening. I'm just letting you know, we're not talking about prostate cancer this evening. And that is because we intend to do an entire segment on men's health. However, men are also at risk of colon cancer. So because it is one of the most commonly occurring cancers, and certainly one of the most commonly ones related to death in Barbados, I thought it would be important that we deal with colorectal carcinoma. So, Dr. Padmore, going back to screening, because as you said, screening is where you are looking for any evidence of any abnormality before you are symptomatic. Okay, can you share with us some of the different screening modalities and possibly when one should go for them? We do know that in other jurisdictions, we have national screening programs. That's not the case here in Barbados. Probably something that we can hopefully look forward to at some point in time in the future for a lot of the various cancers. But let's talk about some of those various screening modalities that are available locally for us to be better aware of where we are in terms of our status.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good question, Adana. So when we look at different options available, so firstly, yes, as you rightly said, there are different screening modalities available for colon cancer, but then you have to look at which ones are, what we say, is most sensitive, meaning which ones, if the result is positive or what, will be able to detect the disease. But the options available, you have minimal or non-invasive options such as stool testing. There are different types of stool testing available, and what that stool testing does is it depending on the test, it looks to identify blood in the stool, and all the blood isn't visible to the naked eye. So there's the fecal occult blood testing, and there's also immunochemical testing, which is a FIT testing for various DNA markers in the stool, which may be present for in the presence of colon cancer. These tests are tests that are done similarly for screening at from the age of 45. However, they don't diagnose the problem. They kind of trigger the next step. And the next step generally for any positive stool test, for example, would be for a a camera test of the colon, which is a colonoscopy. There are different types of colonoscopies. Some patients have you have a virtual colonoscopy or a colonography, which is where it is a CT imaging done, where you take CAT scan takes pictures of the colon, and you can detect some abnormalities that way. However, similarly, that is mainly a diagnostic test, so it can pick up things, but at the end of the day, you still need to do a formal colonoscopy to actually get a biopsy or take a piece of any growths that may be present, or even if it's a polyp, to try to remove that polyp. As a whole, each test has different guidelines on when you should repeat them. So the stool testing, if it is negative, you should get it repeated in a few years' time. And all of this should be guided by your family doctor or general practitioners in terms of what the guidelines for you for that particular test that you're choosing to do. And this is the ideal scenario, Adana. We then have to look at what is available in our population, in our island, mainly because we always have a lot of limitations. So in the public system at the hospital, colonoscopies are they're very heavily requested. So any national screening program, we also have to look at who's doing the actual screening tests. So we can't just blanketly say this has to happen without actually helping the persons that are actually doing the tests with the resources, et cetera, to carry out these tests, because then you will definitely will get a bottleneck. Patients that need it, but then have difficulty in getting it. But on a whole, we have blood fecal occult or stool testing. And then the gold standard for colon cancer screening will be colonoscopy, which is looking to see, and generally should start around the age of 45 in the average risk population.
Okay, great. Dr. Chatrani, you sort of hinted at the testing modality that gynecologists use on their end to be able to screen for the presence of HPV or any precancerous or even cancerous cells associated with the cervix. And you sort of walked us through that process. Exactly what are you doing when you take a pap smear as a gynecologist? Because I know that there are certain components, and so that ladies can understand exactly what you're looking for. And just as for our younger listeners who may not as yet have undergone a pap smear, so that they understand what the process is all about.
Okay, thank you, Adana. Mm-hmm. So there are five areas below the belt that can undergo cancerous change in a woman. The vulva, which is the lips, the vagina, which is the birth canal, the cervix, which is the top of the vagina or the neck of the womb, and that's where we do our pap smears, the uterus, which is the womb and its lining, which is the endometrium. That lining is what sheds every month when you don't conceive, when you don't get pregnant. So we say it's the womb crying every month, and then the ovaries and the tubes. So what you have to understand specifically is when you go to a gynecologist for a pap smear, he will check the lips, which is the vulva, he will check the vagina, and then he would focus on the cervix. So he actually, in that one visit, look at three areas that could potentially undergo cancerous change. So the woman who's never had a pap smear has to realize, well, it's a very intimate exam. They come into the doctor's office, they undress down below, they cover themselves with a sheet, they lie down on a bed with stirrups, they put their feet up in the stirrups, and they have a gentle speculum examination. Now, I know most women complain that's a very cold instrument that they use, because in the hospital we use these stainless steel ones to be able to reuse, but you can get, you know, warmers and jelly to help warm it a little bit so it's not as uncomfortable, a little bit more palatable. And what we do when we insert that speculum is that we visualize the cervix. And most women will have a normal appearing cervix. And it does not mean that because it looks normal, it is normal. So what we are doing with the pap smear is that we are using a brush and just taking some of the cells of the cervix. And these cells are then sent to a laboratory, and a cytologist, somebody trained specifically to examine these cells, or a pathologist, looks at them under the microscope. And they can detect features or changes in these cells that would kind of highlight that these cells are undergoing a transformation, that they're infected with the HPV virus. And they can grade that transformation to say, well, it's low grade, intermediate grade, or high grade. And once you have an abnormal pap smear, so majority of the women will have normal pap smears. If you have an abnormal pap smear, the next step then is to get that entire cervix examined with a microscope. And they tend to hear that big word colposcopy. And I'm going to break it down. Colpo is Latin for cervix. Oscopy means to look at with a microscope. So instead of just sending a few cells to the lab for these technologists to examine them, we bring the microscope to the patient now in colposcopy, where we magnify the entire cervix, look at it with the microscope, identify the areas that look abnormal. We use special solutions to highlight those areas and want a better sample, because what you want to confirm is which type of abnormality you're dealing with, whether it be a low grade, intermediate, or high grade, so it can determine the right treatment for you. And when I say the right treatment, I know a lot of our listeners have probably gone through this process before, and I've kind of broken it down, simplified. But the treatments for low grade, you can actually freeze those cells. And if you freeze them, what you do, you freeze the virus inside the cell as well, and those abnormal cells will then melt away and get rid of them. So you go back to normal. If you have a little bit more intermediate or high grade abnormality going on, then we want to use a laser, or that's a colloquial term that we use, but we want to use an excision technique where we remove those abnormal cells. We call that a loop cone. And we send that tissue to the lab then to confirm that all of it is removed, so that when you finish your treatment, you know that you are free of disease. So you don't then have to worry about this becoming a problem later. You continue to do your pap smears on a yearly basis and make sure they remain normal. And once you remove that precancerous disease, then it eliminates your risk of cancer.
Great. And I know our listeners usually are listening quite intently, and I didn't mention this evening the numbers that they can call in, although I know they probably already know. But if you wish to call in to the studio this evening, our numbers are 434-1790. And for those persons who are not that comfortable calling in, certainly you can still WhatsApp us on 266-4862. And that number again is 266-4862. So, Dr. Padmore, I want to know, because we know that, as you stated, resources can be limited. You don't want a situation where you have multiple persons turn up because there's age-appropriate screening. And then we can also have persons who may present because they're having symptoms. And I know we want to get persons screened, but it's still important and good to know about what are the symptoms usually associated with colon cancer, certainly so that you can act early. Can you tell us about some of those symptoms?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thanks, Adana. Just to touch back on screening, you talked about the age that we should start at, which is 45 for the average risk, but it always is a cutoff as well, which is 75 years old. And after 75, there generally is a discussion about with your family doctor or GP if to continue at that point. So in terms of the symptoms now, again, this is, as you rightly said, this is something that we want to catch before symptoms arise, but still there are patients on different ends of the spectrum. So worrisome features or symptoms include any blood in the stool that isn't normal. That blood can be mixed in or separate from the stool. Patients that have weight loss that is unexplained, in addition to changes in the stool habits or stool caliber. So the colon has a right side, a middle portion, and a left side. And the ones on the left side, as that side of the colon tends to be easier to obstruct, those patients tend to present more with changes in the stool caliber, meaning the size of the stool. So in essence, what the patient will notice is that they had regular sizable stools, but then in notice it starts to become pencil-like. And that is in keeping with the lumen of that side of the colon getting narrow. Again, try not to disregard these symptoms. Constipation definitely is something that on its own is not a red flag, but rather changes in your normal bowel habit. So everyone has their variant of normal for them. But if you find that your bowel habits are changing from your norm, in addition to the size of the stool, noticing blood in the stool, those are all red flags. Compared to the tumors on the right side of the colon, the right side tends to be bigger than the left. So for them to obstruct, it takes a little longer. But these patients with the right-sided tumors, those tumors tend to bleed more often than not. So patients will notice symptoms of anemia, which include fatigue at exertion, tiredness, and actually noticing blood in the stools. And this is important that you should take a look at your stool, looking for any blood. And the blood can be mixed in with the stool, and it generally should be a red flag. So in essence, a danit is a combination of things that can occur, not one symptom. But the key take home point I want persons to know is not to ignore, because what you might notice is that symptoms occur, it may not happen with every bowel movement, especially if you notice in blood in the stool, but quite often you see patients who have noticed things going on for a few months before they present. So anything like that, you should really have a review and get it checked out.
Dr. Chatrani, thank you, Dr. Padmore. And Dr. Chatrani, certainly, what are some of those symptoms that women may encounter with cervical cancer? But before you answer that question, I think Gregson has a call for us this evening. Gregson, I'm going to turn over to you.
Yes, please. Good evening. Are you still with us?
Peace be unto you and yours. Yes, good evening, and to your distinguished guests.
Yes, go right ahead. They can hear you.
Good evening to everyone. Very educational and interested. And I hope that a lot of people listening will take heed to what you all say. Well, I got a second chance. And every day, every minute, every second, I thank my Creator for giving me that second chance. But a lot of my family, Dr. Chat, one of you know me because you were my mom, doctor. I lose my mom, I use my sister, I use my stepfather, I use cousins from cancer. So whenever you hear cancer, it really hurts. But I heard you say something just now. You said there are five below the belt. You love that phrase, below the belt. I never knew that, but what we would call the lips, that the lips would be cancerous also. Hello?
Yes, yes, thank you, and God bless you. I mean, you had to go through a lot of struggle. Glad that you are here. The lips or the vulva can also undergo cancerous change, and these are often seen more in the elderly, and they have been also affiliated with the same HPV virus. But the good news about vulval cancer, or the lips down there, is called vulval, is not that common. It's less than 1%. So you don't diagnose it often, you don't see it often, but when you do, people tend to ignore it. They usually get changes in the color of the skin, or the skin becomes what we call hypopigmented. You know, it loses the pigmentation. There's usually a lesion that they think is just a boil or a waxen kernel, and they scratch it, and it gets infected, and then they get treated with the antibiotics. So once you're in that age group, and that age group is usually above the age of 60, and you have any problems down there, you should present to your gynecologist just for them to check it. And obviously, if they give you creams or treatment for it and it resolves, then fine, it's not cancerous. But if it persists, and that's what Dr. Padmore was saying, you know, if you notice any change in your body, don't ignore it, especially if the change lasts more than 2 weeks. I mean, he made comments about your bowel movements. But you know, sometimes when you overeat or you eat something bad, your bowels can change a little bit. But if that change then becomes the norm for you, then that is not normal, right? So I always tell my patients, if something changes and it persists for more than 2 weeks, that is a red flag. And that's when you should seek medical attention.
Well, I want to thank, I saw changes in my bowels too, and I decided to go. And I want to thank Dr. Ward, that he was at Warren. And then I went on to QEH. I had to do some private tests because QEH, you know, they don't have everything. But I want to thank everybody. And I am on Dr. Bernstein Clinic. And I want to thank him and all of his staff, especially Dr. Gill, who've been there for me. I owe him my life. And I thank him. I was almost, if I didn't act early, I would have had cancer also. So I thank God for that. And as you say, whenever you go to the toilet, you should always check everything, your urine, your stool, everything. And as you say, if you have something and keep on coming persistent, you should go and see. I know sometimes things may be expensive. And I feel everybody should get it. You must tell people that every year, try and go and get a colonoscopy. It may be expensive, but it will prolong your life. Thank you all very much. And this, I want to thank VOB, you know, for bringing all these things to us and enlightening us and educating us in a lot of things, health and otherwise. Thank you all. I'll continue to bless you all and bless this country. And I would like to see our health system up and running good again, because we was the beacon of the Caribbean. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you, caller. Thank you kindly.
Thank you, Father.
Dr. Chatrani, I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Don't run away yet, because I've got a message here for you. Let me see if I can find it. It says, I just want to say all my life after the Almighty to Dr. Chatrani and his team. May he be blessed. So somebody knows you. And next question, it says, in fact, two people are asking basically the same question, two different people. This one says, good evening. I had a hysterectomy. Do I still have to get a PAPS test? I believe they're referring to Pap smear test. And the other person is saying, good evening, Gregson. The question for Dr. Chatrani, if a person has had a total hysterectomy at 29, do you still have to get a Pap smear? Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Gregson. And thank you, caller, for your question. So when we talk about a hysterectomy, the name itself actually comes from hundreds of years ago, because they thought back then removing the uterus was removing the woman's hysteria. Just adding that little humor here today, because we know that's not true. That still remains with them lifelong. But there are two types of hysterectomy. There is the subtotal and the total. The subtotal hysterectomy removes just the uterus alone. The total hysterectomy removes the uterus and the cervix. This does not have anything to do with the tubes and the ovaries, which are the appendages attached to the uterus. Those are a separate part of the procedure when we do a hysterectomy, called a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, or what we call a BSO. When you remove the ovaries, you actually take away the hormones and the eggs, and that can send them into menopause. So for our 29-year-old caller, said she had a hysterectomy. The most common cause for us to do a hysterectomy is something like uterine fibroids. If she had a total hysterectomy, it means they removed her uterus and her cervix. She needs to confirm that both the uterus and the cervix are removed. If her pap smears were normal before the removal of the uterus and the cervix, and what we do when we take out the uterus and the cervix and we send it to the lab for analysis, they look at the cervix in detail and make sure it's normal. And if that came back, that result came back normal, then she does not need to do pap smears. The other caller said she had a hysterectomy. So I don't know if they took out just the uterus or the uterus and the cervix. You need clarity on that. When we do pap smears, we do it from the age of 21 to the age of 65. So if she's still within that category and she still has her cervix, then she needs to continue doing her pap smears.
All right. I hope both those writers are listening to the response. And then there's someone suggesting, or rather asking, very humorously, was something put in black people's genes? They're finding that they're so predisposed to nearly all of these diseases you guys are discussing. Do you care to comment?
Well, I can comment because 80% of our women in the Caribbean actually have a condition called uterine fibroids, which is a benign tumor that grows in the uterus. What they've actually found throughout research is why these women present with cancer is because they have poor access to healthcare. So we heard our caller saying, you know, she went to the hospital, she only got some of the tests done, but she took it upon herself to go outside the hospital and pay for certain tests. So when they do the research and they see the cancer levels to be higher in these women, it's not because genetically they're more predisposed to it. It may be in some cases they have poor access to healthcare just because of the regions in which they live, because governments is what dictate your healthcare, the lack of insurance and the lack of good healthy behavior in terms of, you know, eating well, exercising, visiting your doctor regularly. So it is not necessarily a genetic predisposition, but more of a circumstance, for lack of a better description.
All right.
Dr. Padma, you agree?
Yeah, I agree. There is some in the Afro-Caribbean, African-American for colon cancer for sure, though, in terms of a higher predisposition. But in general, it all boils down to persons being meticulous with their health, making sure if you have any red flags, trying to get seek attention early, because interventions can occur before things reach to that point of actual cancer developing. So it's a combination of everything.
Thank you. One of our callers said you must do your colonoscopy every year.
Yeah.
I want to address that before we move on.
Yeah, for sure.
And
for sure.
I had mine last year in August, and I don't think it's every year the doctor
Yeah, that's correct. So just to clarify for everyone, for screening, meaning asymptomatic persons from the age of 45, if that colonoscopy was normal, the next time is 10 years, it would be the recommendation. If a polyp was found or polyps were found, generally they may drop it to about 3 years for a repeat, but not yearly. Yearly is more for the stool testing. So the stool testing are done yearly because of the pickup rate. And then if the stool testing is positive, then that is when you go on to the colonoscopy as the next step.
All right. Before I hand back over to Dr. Grandison, there's a query here for you, Dr. Padmore. Is it correct to say that someone is cancer-free? If yes, does it mean that that person wouldn't get it again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Greg. So that's an excellent question. So in oncology, whether it's surgical oncology, gynecology, oncology, you'll hear us seldomly tell someone they're cancer-free, mainly because things take time, right? In general, a patient that is 5-10 years post a cancer diagnosis and treatment, it is only then we will say, you know, things are looking in your favor. But we generally hesitantly say that you're free. We generally follow patients after surgery. That is why you see the follow-up intervals. For example, for colon cancer, we'll be seeing that patient every 3 months for the first 2 years, every 6 months between years 2 to 5, yearly. They're varying time schedules based on how your surveillance protocols dictate. However, we don't do a procedure and then tell a patient they're free of cancer, because we know things can take a while to recur. Dr. Charani, anything to add to that?
Yes. So I know, thank you, Greg. I know our patients like to know they're cured. They like that word cured, right? So when they undergo surgery, we are always tempted, because we know we get most of the tumor, nearly all of the tumor removed, and there's no evidence of any residual disease. And you want to use that word to make them feel good about themselves, that they did the right thing, they had the surgery, and they're cured. But the thing about cancer is, once you've had cancer in your lifetime, you can get cancer again. And it doesn't mean that it is new cancer again. It doesn't mean it's recurrent. We don't know, right? obviously, if you've had a diagnosis of cancer before and it comes back again 5-10 years down the line. So we don't like to use that word cure because we don't want to offer false promises to them that, you know, everything has been removed, because it's always at risk of coming back. And what this allows us to do is then to offer the necessary surveillance where we continue to check them and make sure they remain cancer free. Right? But we never use, or we don't like to use the word cure, because there's always a risk of recurrence.
Okay. Last question before we hand over to Dr. Grandison again. Can you have a colonoscopy after 67 years?
Yep. That can be, the recommendation is up to age 75. So yes, will be the answer. Of course, always have a discussion with your family physician or a general practitioner about when to continue. But generally, after 75 years old, you got to look at the life expectancy of the individual and the risk of finding something and the intervention to that patient on finding it. So, for example, if you have a patient who's 85 years old, you've done a colonoscopy for some reason, and you found a colon cancer, is that patient fit enough for an operation, for example? Would that operation change a patient's life expectancy? So that's why you'll find the cutoff is age 75 for the average population.
Okay, Dr. Grandison?
Yes, thank you so much, Gregson. And I like what Dr. Chatrani stated in terms of being a bit more reserved when commenting about being cancer-free and using that word cure. Because when we think about cancer, going back to the definition that we had earlier in terms of uncontrolled cellular growth, we can remove what we can see. And there's always the possibility that the cancer on a cellular level, so the small little building blocks that make up that big mass, has spread via the blood or the lymphatic drainage. And so it can go some other place. Yes, there are other modalities, not just going to surgery and cutting that mass or removing the cervix. But there are other modalities of using things like radiation and chemotherapy. But we are a bit more reserved when it comes to using those terms because, again, as Dr. Chatrani beautifully stated, we don't want to give any false hopes and false impressions. And I think setting the appropriate expectation with a patient is absolutely critical, because it also empowers the patient to be on the lookout in the event that they should notice something again happening, that they are quicker to respond to that change that is occurring. And I actually heard one of the listeners speaking about sometimes the gap that can occur in terms of the access to care. And this is not a problem just localized and encountered in Barbados. This is a gap that we see internationally. Certainly, we know that there is the gap when it comes to, for instance, females presenting and getting healthcare sometimes. We also know that persons from lower socioeconomic brackets can have difficulty accessing healthcare. We also know that the mortality, especially we know now that more than 90% of cervical cancer mortality generally tends to occur in low to middle income societies. So the gap actually occurs, and we really want to close that gap. I think the only way that we can close that gap is really by, one, educating ourselves, to communicating with each other. And I think that's why it's so important to understand family history and understanding what happens within the Barbadian context and wider Caribbean context. But certainly then going out and acting, going out and getting screened, know your status, checking up on yourself, checking up on your friend. But the only way we can do that is also by knowing the symptoms. So Dr. Padmore told us some of the symptoms for colon cancer, and I'm getting right back to Dr. Chatrani. No, because yes, all of our patients won't present asymptomatic. Some of us will have symptoms. So tell us, Dr. Chatrani, some of the symptoms that females can be on the lookout for that might signal, I need to go to the doctor.
Correct. Okay, so cervical cancer symptoms. Remember, I don't want you to get cervical cancer. I want you to do your pap smears and prevent this. But in the event that you're not getting screened or you haven't had a pap smear recently, these are some red flags that should make you go to your family physician or your gynecologist, because it's not normal. So bleeding from the vagina after sexual intercourse, what we call postcoital bleeding, so bleeding after sex, that is a flag. It may not be cancer. It could be an infection. It could be inflammation of the cervix. But that is definitely one that we have to look out for. The other one, bleeding after menopause. Menopause is that time of life, usually around 50 to 53, where your periods stop. It's not when you put men on pause. It basically means your periods stop. And periods are not like governments. They don't come back into power. So when your period done, it's supposed to be finished altogether. So if a year or 2 years later you get back a bleed, it don't mean that your period come back. That is abnormal. That is called postmenopausal bleeding. You need to go to your doctor for that. So we have bleeding after sex, bleeding after menopause. Those are two common ones. If you're bleeding between your periods, say your periods come every 28 days and you realize now day 12 you're getting a bleed, that is not normal. That is called intermenstrual bleeding. You need to come to your doctor to get that checked out. If you're having a change in your vaginal discharge, say it becomes watery, it has an odor associated with it, that is not normal. You go to your doctor. And then obviously if you're getting pain down below, pain in your pelvis, pain during sex, you need to present to your doctor, because obviously something is up and something is wrong. These are the symptoms of cervical cancer, but as I said, this is the most preventable cancer. So you should not be waiting for symptoms to develop before you come to your doctor. You should be going regularly and getting screened. Now, Dr. Padmore made an important point about life expectancy. We tend to screen women from the age of 21 to the age of 65, but we found that our women are living longer. I remember when I came back to Barbados in 2012, having just finished my fellowship, there was this lady who was having this burning and this pain on her vulva, which is not a common cancer to develop. And when I saw her, she was 95 years of age. But when she walked into the waiting room, she didn't look like 95. Yes, she had a cane, but she wasn't using it. Her hair was gray. Actually, she had these shimmering lights. You know, it was nice and purple. She had these little two earrings. And she had no high blood pressure, no diabetes, no other illnesses. And when I looked at this lady here and I saw this lesion, I said, she needs treatment. She needs surgery. And when I called the anesthetist to say, let's put her to sleep and get the surgery done, he said, 95? She has lived her life. Let her die in peace. And, you know, when you read guidelines and they say, boy, you know, the life expectancy for a 95-year-old, she's just good to have been alive that long. Why offer her any treatment? And we went back and forth. And in the end, you know, we wanted to make her comfortable. And they end up doing a spinal where they didn't put her to sleep, but they just numbed down below. And we removed the tumor. They told me the spinal was going to take 2 hours to wear off. And we just wanted to cut out the tumor. And then when they told me 2 hours, I said, we can do the full surgery. I'm happy to report 11 years later, this lady is now 106 years of age. And there's no evidence of any recurrence. She's cancer-free. But I would never have imagined, you know, she would have lived till 106. She even had cataract surgery after that. So even though we say, what the Bible says, Adana, when it talks about life expectancy, Greg's
might... Three score and ten.
Right, but that's 70, but we know we're living longer now. Advanced healthcare. So when we say stop doing tests or stop going to the doctor because you've lived your life, I think there's still value if you have a healthy lifestyle, you don't have any comorbidities, you're keeping fit and trim and you're active, to still seek healthcare.
And I think that's absolutely important, because every 70 doesn't look the same, you know. So... And that is another inequality that we do see in healthcare, because sometimes persons are often quick to say, oh, that person has lived their life. You know, we really can't offer any additional intervention because they might. But we also know that there are some persons who are very fit and strong 70s. And so it's very, very important to treat each case as it comes to you. And I want to take these last few moments to really look at some of the myths that are associated with screening surrounding some of these malignancies. And Dr. Padmore, we often hear a person say, oh, I'm not doing any colonoscopy because it's going to hurt.
Oh.
Tell us about that. Is a colonoscopy painful?
Well, in general, when a colonoscopy is done, the gastroenterologist will be using some form of sedation. So they are given medication to make the test more tolerable. It generally shouldn't hurt, but you are not fully awake during the procedure. And that is really because when they do the test, it is being done with air. So the colon is being inflated with air to help them adequately visualize the lining of the colon. But during that procedure, it can take anywhere from 20-30 minutes, just depends on the difficulty. It is under some form of sedation.
Great.
Dr. Granderson, forgive me a second, sure. Please. Just one last query before you move away from Dr. Padmore. Speaking of colonoscopies, this person is saying, can you get cancer from hemorrhoids? I have had 3 colonoscopies and was never told of any problems. Can you get cancer from hemorrhoids?
Well, the hemorrhoids themselves are, as everyone knows, is a common issue. And they are really just dilated blood vessels around the anus, which is the end of the rectum. The hemorrhoids themselves don't generally progress into cancer. However, one of the important things I want listeners to take away is that the presence of hemorrhoids and bleeding, you should not attribute the bleeding to only hemorrhoids. You always must make sure, especially if you're above the age of 40 to 45, see your doctor, because we just need to make sure the rest of your colon and your rectum are okay before we say that bleeding is hemorrhoidal bleeding. But directly speaking, hemorrhoids are not cancers. You can have anal cancers, which are in the same region, but they tend to not to be related. They're kind of two separate issues.
Dr. Granderson?
Yes, thank you. And Dr. Chatrani, can a lady have a baby now that she's had cervical cancer? Because a lot of women certainly are concerned, you know, I don't know if I want to know, I don't know if I want to, because I am thinking about this and I can't handle the bad news.
Right. So cervical cancer definitely affects your fertility because the treatments either involve removing the cervix and the uterus, giving chemotherapy or radiation, which can, in its sense, damage the ovaries and the ability to produce eggs and whatnot. But it all depends on the stage, because if you get cervical cancer early or you get these abnormalities early, you can provide fertility sparing treatment that these women can still go on and have successful pregnancies and deliveries. So when I say cervical cancer is going down, the reason it's going down is because people are coming forward early, getting screened. If they have abnormalities, it doesn't mean they have cancer. We use the word precancer, and that scares people. And that's why I try not to use the word precancer, because yes, if left untreated, it will develop cancer, but it's so far remote. It's not like a week or 2 weeks or 6 weeks will make a difference. It takes years. So if we can offer the treatments early, these are all usually fertility sparing treatments and women conceive. But if they do develop cancer, it all depends on the stage and the treatment that they have to undergo to help prevent that.
Great. Dr. Chatrani, I want to leave a question with you for you to spend the last few moments really educating our listeners about the importance of possibly considering the HPV vaccine. I know there was a lot of discussion out there in terms of young children possibly getting this vaccine. We know that the age has certainly been extended where young adults or what we would now call middle age based upon the new definitions of age in medical space. But tell us a bit about the HPV vaccine and certainly how effective it is and really what does it protect you against?
Very good question, Adana. So We've been hearing a lot about vaccines, especially since the pandemic. And before the pandemic, there was the launch in 2010 of the HPV vaccine.
Correct.
So, cervical cancer has decreased since the 1970s, since the advent of the pap smear. We picked up abnormalities and we prevented cancer, but that level has sort of plateaued. And when this gentleman, Harald Zuhausen, won the Nobel Prize, proving that cervical cancer in over 99% of the cases was due to a virus, HPV, that's when the scientists went to look at, let's get a vaccine that can prevent HPV infection. So what you are doing by giving a vaccine is now you are preventing the infection, the persistent infection with HPV, which causes abnormal cells, which leads to cancer. So it's a new armamentarium. You see, I think the biggest problem we had with the HPV vaccine is that we introduced it in schools, and that's not the problem. Because when you give a vaccine in school, what the school has to do is to send the parent a consent form, and they have to sign it. And any good parent is going to go and Google and research their own research on the vaccine. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. Now, when your babies had the, for example, the MMR vaccine, you didn't have to sign something. And obviously, you just took the baby to the clinic, you lift up the sleeve, you try to distract them, and they got the MMR vaccine. The HPV vaccine went through years of testing and years of follow-up before its implementation. And we are seeing the fruits now. It's now 13 years, 14, nearly 15 years since the vaccine has been introduced. Side effects, minimum, like any other vaccine. You know, when you give a baby a vaccine, they get a little fever and an irritation at the injection site and whatnot. Same side effects, nothing different to the common vaccines. And what we've seen in those years is a reduction in not only warts, but a reduction in abnormalities of the cervix, a reduction in women having to go and get that test called colposcopy done. And we may even see in the future that women who have received the vaccine probably don't need to get pap smears as often, because we're now seeing the benefits of it. Now, when that vaccine was launched in Barbados, it was a tough economical time for the country. The government was facing a lot of challenges with regards to expenses and not having the money in their coffers to spend on healthcare. And people questioned it and said, well, how they could spend $150,000 on vaccinating, you know, our girls entering secondary school when they don't have enough money to spend on healthcare. The reason they're able to spend that is because we spend in Barbados over $1.5 million a year treating cervical cancer. So if you could put $150,000 down into a vaccine that could prevent cervical cancer down the line, you're actually saving money. And the vaccine came from a grant from the Pan American Health Organization, PAHO, under the WHO, given at a subsidized cost, that it made economic sense. So yes, there was hesitation initially. The uptake was about 50, 60%, but it has skyrocketed now. People have seen the importance of vaccines. They're getting more and more evidence that it works. And this is the new armamentarium in fighting and preventing cervical cancer. And may even prevent abnormalities, or has prevented abnormalities on the cervix, that you may even be able in the future to say, if I'm vaccinated, I don't need to get pap smears as often.
Dr. Sharon, I just want to ask you one last question before I end off with Dr. Padmore. And that is, we often speak about vaccinating the ladies, but here's where men can play their part. Should men be also getting vaccinated to protect themselves against HPV?
Very good question. So when only 50% of our girls took up the vaccine and they had the vaccine available, they started offering it to boys. When you vaccinate the boys and the girls, you get something called herd immunity. You vaccinate everybody. So how the girls get it? They get it from the boys. How the boys get it? They get it from the girls. And you have to realize that HPV, as that caller had asked about vulval cancer, doesn't only cause cancer of the cervix. It causes cancer of the vulva, cancer of the vagina. It causes head and neck cancers, oral pharyngeal cancers, penile cancer, anal cancer. So when you vaccinate girls and then you extend it to boys, you actually prevent other cancers in men and more cancers in women too as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chatrani. Dr. Padmore, I want to end with you because certainly we know that there's a huge burden and certainly a change in the quality of life that one can have after having major colon surgery, especially if there's a need to have the bringing out of the bowel or a stoma onto the actual abdominal wall. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because certainly that in itself should be a catalyst to really drive persons to get screened, because that does come with a significant change in lifestyle mm-hmm. and a significant financial burden.
So I don't want the public to take away. So any colon cancer surgery or rectal cancer surgery, having a bag is not a must. So that is part of the procedure that may be necessary depending on the location, whether you present it as an emergency or an elective procedure. But having a bag on its own, which is where, as Dr. Grandison rightly said, is where we bring a part of the colon or small bowel to the skin, can be temporary, meaning it can be reversed down the road or it can be permanent, but it really depends on the presentation or where the tumor is located. But again, surgery for colon cancer is a common surgery that we do, depending on which part of the colon is affected. But again, we want to catch patients before we reach to that point. But at the same time, a lot can be done even if you do have colon cancer, even if you have colon cancer that has spread to the liver, for example. There are interventions that we can do, surgery, and we always take a multidisciplinary approach. So it's not only surgeons, we have the oncologists, medical and radiation oncologists to help. These are the doctors that administer chemotherapy and radiation. So it's a team of us. So it's not just one person that is going to be taking care of you during this problem.
Well, Dr. Padmore and Dr. Chatrani, I want to say thank you very much. I want to leave one thing with our listeners, certainly this evening. And when we think about cancer, and we know that there's a gap that certainly exists in possibly not only the access to care, but certainly the differences that we can see even within the various social economic brackets of society, the one thing that we can do is really to empower ourselves and to know our bodies. And the best way that we can do that is to really know your status. And what better way can you know your status apart from screening? So I just want to say thank you very much to Dr. Padmore and Dr. Chatrani. You know, you guys are really, really busy, and I know that it is really beneficial for these two topics to be discussed. I know we could probably continue to talk for the entire evening, but Gregson would not have that because we have other we have other shows this evening on 92.9. But I want to say thank you so much for joining us this evening, Dr. Padmore and Dr. Chatrani.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Gregson, I'm going to turn back over to you at this point in time because I know I am 7 minutes over time.
That's all right. We got you covered, Dr. Grandison. Big thank you to Dr. Greg Padmore. Good name there, Greg. Very good. I like that one a lot. And Dr. Chatrani, Vikash Chatrani, we want to thank you both for coming along and help us sort out some of these issues on the Better Health Radio Show. Your presenter this evening was Dr. Dana Grandison. Will she be here next weekend? Like I asked the last presenter. Will you be, Dr. Grandison?
I will.
Oh, you will be?
I certainly will.
All right, wonderful.
Yes, I
will. All right, good to have you. Okay.
So I'll see you next weekend, Gregson.
Wonderful, take care. Until next weekend, have a good evening, doctors. Nice to have you all here. And don't forget, next weekend, 6 o'clock in the evening, Sunday, another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. Have a good evening, everyone.